About today is joint work with Oliver Jordan, and it concerns one of my favorite topics, the so-called phase transition in random graph processes. So what is the natural context here? So the natural context here is this classical Alder-Schwenny reference model. So the way I want to look at it here is that we start off with an empty graph on n vertices, say these red dots. And now on each step, we want to add a new random edge to this graph. So say in the first step, we decide to add this edge, then we decide to add this edge, and so on and so forth. In the end, we're going to be interested in the typical properties of the resulting graph. And typical, in the sense, how does the graph look like if the number of vertices gets very large? So in my opinion, one of the most remarkable and fascinating results in this area is due to Paul Eldridge and Alfred Rainey, who discovered basically that after inserting roughly n half many edges, the size and the structure of the largest component undergoes quite a dramatic change. We go from a situation where all the components are relatively small, like in this picture down here, to a situation where one very big giant component emerges. This is where a phase transition happens. So to be a little bit more formal, let's look at the size of the largest component after t times n many steps, where t is some fixed constant. Then the result says that with high probability, meaning with probability tending to 1, as the number of vertices n tends to infinity, then with high probability, the size of the largest component is at most logarithmic in size if t is smaller than 1 half, whereas if t is bigger than 1 half, then with high probability, a linear-sized giant component emerges, a component which contains a constant fraction of all vertices of the graph. Okay, so intuitively, what's going on? We're going from the situation here from the left-hand side to the situation on the right-hand side. Of course, we know much, much more precise results about Alder-Schwenny nowadays. So, for example, we could also ask ourselves, what if we do not just insist on t being smaller than 1 half or bigger than 1 half? What happens if we, say, look at t equals to 1 half minus epsilon or t equals to 1 half plus epsilon? What can we then say about the size of the largest component in terms of epsilon? And for example, here, if you look at this case, t equals to 1 half plus epsilon, then for small epsilon, it's well known that the size of this linear-sized giant component is roughly 4 epsilon n for small epsilon. And of course, we know even much more precise results where, for example, you can allow epsilon now also to depend on n. But that's not the direction I want to go today. Today, I do not want to prove more precise results about Alder-Schwenny. Today, the idea will be that I want to obtain similar fine results like these ones here, but for a more complicated class of random graph processes, in particular for random graph processes where we have dependencies between the edges. And in this context, so-called Achleopoulos processes have become a key example. So how are they defined? Well, the idea here is that you can think of these Achleopoulos processes as variations or perturbations of the original Alder-Schwenny random graph model. So as in Alder-Schwenny, we again start off with this empty graph on n vertices. But now, instead of just adding purely random edges, as in Alder-Schwenny, now what we're going to do is each time, in each step, we're going to sample two random edges. And then given the choice between these two random edges, we're only going to select one of them and add it to the evolving graph using some ruler protocol. Okay, so the key idea is in each round, I give you two random edges, and you only add one of them to the evolving graph. Note that this really does not define just one process, but actually a family of random graph processes, because you can decide on the ruler protocol that you want to use for selecting one of these two edges. In particular, say, if you always decide to add the first edge without even looking at it, what you're really doing is you're just adding purely random edges to the graph. In other words, you really recover the classical Alder-Schwenny random graph model. This is also a good time to mention that for everything I'm going to talk about today, it does not matter if you sample the edges with or without replacement, or in fact, if instead of sampling two random edges, you simply sample four random vertices and then pretend that they're the endpoints of your two random edges. It makes no difference whatsoever. Okay, so now that we've seen the classical reference model, this new model, I think it's a good time to ask ourselves, why should we care? What is really the motivation for studying these processes? Here I want to discuss two of them. One is more of a conceptual nature, and one is more of a technical nature. So from a conceptual point of view, we really want to improve our understanding of the phase transition phenomena in such random discrete structures. We want to understand why does the phase transition happen and what are the key parameters involved. Furthermore, we also want to address this universality question, meaning we want to understand which properties are specific to one model, like, say, Adler-Schrenny, and which are universal in the sense that they hold actually in a wide range of models. So the second motivation here is really more of a technical nature. So the point is that nowadays we have an extremely good understanding of Adler-Schrenny, but if you look into the proofs, you'll see that most of these tools and techniques that we use for analyzing Adler-Schrenny, that they actually crucially exploit the fact that we can generate this graph as a sequence of independent random choices. As soon as you start introducing some dependencies between the edges, most of these techniques very quickly break down. But look, in this Achleopoulos framework, where you can always select one of these two random edges, it's very easy to introduce quite some significant dependencies between the choices in different rounds, meaning that the decision in one round will depend on many other previous decisions and decisions in previous rounds. And exactly for this reason, these Achleopoulos processes have become sort of a standard testbed for developing new tools and techniques in the context of the phase transition, in particular more robust techniques, say. So what will be my goal? My goal will be to study now the phase transition phenomena in the context of these Achleopoulos processes. And one of the quantities that one can conveniently study here is the fraction of vertices in the largest component. So let me just denote this by, say, rho of t. It's the fraction of vertices in the largest component after t times n many steps. And this way, we can generate some very nice plots. And so what I've done here is, via simulations, showed you the behavior of this quantity in, say, five different Achleopoulos processes. And the red curve corresponds to the Adler-Schrenny reference model. So just as a quick check, we know that in Adler-Schrenny, the giant component starts appearing after roughly n half many steps. So this red curve, this Adler-Schrenny curve here, starts growing at t equals to 1/2, and then it grows in this nice and smooth fashion. Okay, and as you can see now, there are these five different curves corresponding to five different Achleopoulos processes, and we immediately see that there's a quite variety of different behaviors. Some are more of this Adler-Schrenny type, some are very different, and this is one of the reasons why there's been a lot of interdisciplinary interest in these processes. I think there are by now more than, say, 200 papers on this topic, and a lot of it stems from the fact that, for example, here in these two processes over here, we observe a quite more dramatic behavior than just in Adler-Schrenny. So, for example, it was a conjecture by Achleopoulos, de Souza, and Spencer that this actually, say, in the language of mathematical physics, corresponds to a first-order phase transition, meaning that this curve is actually discontinuous at this point. But later turned out, so this is some joint work with Oliver Riada and myself, we actually were able to show that although in this simulation it looks so extremely steep, mathematically it still corresponds to a second-order phase transition. Okay, but that's not what I want to go into too much detail in today. Today the idea will be I want to focus on these classes of rules over here, which are more of this Adler-Schrenny-like behavior, and I want to make a formal statement of the form. In some sense, the phase transition looks like in Adler-Schrenny in a very large class of Achleopoulos processes. So now I need to do two things. I need to tell you what are the classes I'm actually interested in, and what do I mean by looks like in Adler-Schrenny. So let me mention that one of the original motivations for studying these Achleopoulos processes was a question by Dimitris Achleopoulos, who asked, can you come up with a rule or protocol which changes the location of the phase transition? So in other words, you do not want the phase transition to happen after n half many steps, but say substantially later, after 3/4 times n many steps. And in this context, it's very natural to look at the class of size rules. So how do these rules look like? So suppose these two red edges here are the ones offered to your rule. What a size rule will do is it will look at the end vertices of these two edges, say v1, v2, v3, and v4, And for each of these vertices, they will determine the size of the component which currently contains this vertex. Okay, so vertex V1 lies in the component of size C1, vertex V2 lies in the component of size C2, and so on and so forth. So in other words, in each round, your rule determines a list of component sizes. And then the key restriction is that your decision, which of the two edges to add, should only depend on this list of component sizes, nothing more. And if you think about this, for example, in the context of the delay of the phase transition, well, suppose we really wanted to delay the phase transition. What would be a natural idea? Well, we want to avoid creating a linear-sized giant component early on. So one very natural idea would be to say, okay, what we're really doing is we're trying to suppress the creation of big components. So let's just try early on in the process, we try to avoid creating big components. But look, suppose that all these four components are really distinct. Then if we add the first edge, we would create a new component of size C1 plus C2. And if we add the second edge, we create a component of size C3 plus C4. So one very natural suggestion in this context is to say, okay, let's just add the edge here which minimizes the sum of these component sizes, because that's the one which sort of creates the smaller of the two possible components. And this kind of rule actually corresponds to this very dramatic, to this very steep behavior that we've seen on the previous slide. In fact, it was a suggestion by Béla Bolobash that it's even better to replace your sum by the product, but that's not so important for the talk today. In some sense, for my talk here, the main point will be that the general class of size rules is too broad to analyze mathematically. However, there's a very interesting subclass of size rules which we can still analyze mathematically, which is more tractable. So this is the class of so-called bounded size rules, which was suggested by Joel Spencer and Nick Wormald some 15 years ago. And there the idea is that, again, we want to look at size rules, but now we're giving ourselves some cutoff B, and all components larger than B will be treated in the same way. So suppose, for example, that B is equal to 10, then your rule can only distinguish components of size 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 10, and everything larger than 10 will be treated in the same way. So no matter whether your component has size 11, 1,000, 10 million, they will all look the same to your rule. And this already gives you some indication why this class of rules is more tractable than the general class of size rules, because these can only distinguish a finite number of different component sizes. Nevertheless, this class contains a number of very interesting examples. So, of course, this class trivially contains Erdős-Rényi, for example, because to just always add the first edge, you do not need to know any component sizes at all. Furthermore, there's one historically very interesting process, the so-called Bowman-Fries process, which was sort of maybe the first Achleopoulos process that was seriously studied. And I think the idea is quite nice, so let me briefly tell you how this rule looks like. So in Bowman-Fries, what they suggested is, let's just look here at the first edge. Let's just look at the first edge. And we only want to add the first edge if both of these end vertices are isolated, meaning if they have lie in components of size 1. So the rule would be, join the first edge if and only if both of these vertices lie in components of size 1, meaning if C1 and C2 are both equal to 1. If that's not the case, let's just forget about the first edge, let's just forget about it, and add the second edge no matter what. Note that under this kind of rule, whenever you add the second edge, it's just a purely random edge, because the decision whether you added the second edge or not only depended on the component sizes of the first edge. So one sort of potential interpretation of Bowman-Fries is to say, look, what this rule really does is it, in each step, it adds a random edge to the graph, but it gives a slight preference towards these isolated vertices. All right, so in the remainder of the talk, the idea will now be that I want to study the phase transition in these bounded size rules. And I want to tell you a little bit about the history of the problem. And the idea is that along the way, I'm going to remind you a little bit of the typical questions that we tend to ask in percolation theory or random graph theory. So whenever we're given a new model, the first question we should always ask is there a phase transition and where is it located? And this is exactly the question that was addressed in a very nice paper by Joel Spencer and Nick Wormald, where they showed, yes, indeed, for any bounded size rule, there is a critical point at which the phase transition happens. So to be a little bit more formal, what they showed is that for any bounded size rule, there's a critical time TC. And now, of course, the critical time depends on the rule that you're using. There's a critical time TC. So that if you look at the largest component after T times n many steps, then if T is smaller than this critical time, the largest component will be of logarithmic size, where if T is bigger than TC, we already have this linear size giant component. And note that this is exactly of the same form as this basic Erdős-Rényi result I told you about earlier, just that in Erdős-Rényi, this TC was equal to 1/2. And here, the critical time depends on the rule that you're using. In some sense, the critical time is even explicit because the critical time here is given by the blow-up point of a finite system of differential equations. So in principle, you can calculate it up to arbitrary precision. But otherwise, this is exactly of this Erdős-Rényi type form. So now that we've established the existence and location of the phase transition, the next questions we tend to ask concern the finer details of the phase transition, in particular with respect to the size of the largest component. And this was exactly addressed in this work by Svante Janssen and Joel Spencer for the Bowman freeze process we discussed on the previous slide. Okay, so they focused on one particular rule and tried to study the size of the largest component. And in a nutshell, what they showed is that the Bowman freeze process, the size of the largest component, exhibits Erdős-Rényi-like behavior. So what do I mean by exhibits Erdős-Rényi-like behavior? So here, I mean that they proved that there's a rule-dependent constant C, so that if you look at the largest component at TCn plus epsilon n many steps, then it scales for a small epsilon like constant epsilon n. And the point is that this is exactly of the same form as Erdős-Rényi, just that in Erdős-Rényi, your constant TC would be equal to 1/2, and the constant C would be equal to 4. And for Bowman freeze, I think the TC is 0.59, and the constant C is 4.9, I think. Okay, but up to this sort of irrelevant rescaling, we see exactly the same qualitative behavior in Erdős-Rényi and in this Bowman freeze process. So once these results were obtained, sort of the floodgates opened and a lot of follow-up work was done, let me just mention here maybe two or three of them. So one of them, among other things, Domotak, Heng, Panagiotou extended this kind of result to a larger family of rules, not quite the general class of bounded size rules, but some class that contains Erdős-Rényi. Furthermore, there's also been some very nice work by the probability community on this problem, in particular due to Bamidi, Boudir, and Wang, who studied the so-called critical window using results from Aldus concerning the multiplicative coalescence. And in some sense, if Brownian motion is your favorite object to study, then the critical window is perhaps where the most interesting behavior happens. Here in this talk, I want to focus on the perspective of combinatorial probability, where the behavior outside of the critical window is the most interesting thing to study. So what we're able to show is a significant extension and generalization of this previous work. So we can prove in a very strong sense that any bounded size rule exhibits this Erdős-Rényi-like behavior. So maybe to get a feeling of what's going on, let's first study this plot up here. So what I've plotted there is, again, this fraction of vertices in the largest component renormalized by n. And I've plotted this for five different bounded size rules. As usual, the red curve will be the Erdős-Rényi reference model. And what our result in particular implies is that each of these curves initially grows at some linear rate as the Erdős-Rényi one does. So in other words, you can approximate each of these lines initially by a straight line. I'm sorry?
It has a right-sided derivative.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so So in particular, one can sort of argue that sort of the size of the largest component grows at some linear rate just above the critical point. So to be maybe a little bit more formal, what we can prove about the random graph process, not just about the scaling limit, is the following. So we can show that for any bounded size rule, there's a rule-dependent constant C. So as long as epsilon is not too small, then the size of the largest component scales like TCN plus epsilon n, the largest component after step TCN plus epsilon n scales like constant epsilon n. So we get this nice linear type growth behavior even in the process. And let me emphasize this again. In Adasharani, you would see exactly the same picture, TC equal to 1/2, this constant equal to 4. In particular, this restriction that we have here, that epsilon is at least n to the minus 1 over 3, that's also the same condition as in Adasharani, and it basically says that you're outside of the critical window, because inside the critical window, the largest component simply is not concentrated. So what is here the two key differences to previous work? So on the one hand, previous work was focusing on a specific process like Bowman freeze or some class, restricted class of processes. We can handle here the full class of bounded size rules, in fact, some slightly larger family of processes. And conceptually, one key difference is that previous work here, for example, by Janssen Spencer, they were considering fixed epsilon, whereas we can allow epsilon to depend on n. So just to clarify this, in, for example, the result of Janssen Spencer, what they did is they first fixed epsilon, then sent n to infinity, and only afterwards they sent epsilon to 0. Whereas here we can allow epsilon to be a function of n. And this is, of course, much harder to obtain. Let me just mention that, of course, instead of just studying the largest component after the critical point, you can also study it beforehand. And this has also been of great interest, particularly to probabilists. And so they obtained some partial results that did not work all the way up to the critical window. And using our techniques, we can, again, recover this full Adasharani type behavior. So in particular, it turns out that if you look at the largest component at TCN minus epsilon n, then it scales like constant epsilon to the minus 2 log epsilon to the 3n. Okay, just take my word for it, exactly the same behavior as you would see in Adasharani. So let me also mention that if we now put sort of our maybe physics hat on for a moment, then you see that there's a lot of critical exponents floating around. So here, for example, is epsilon to the power of 1, or here this epsilon to the minus 2. And so in the language of mathematical physics, loosely speaking, what this result sort of shows is that all bounded size rules lie in the same universality class as Adasharani. We can also establish a number of further results concerning, say, the size of the largest components, say some more finer details of the behavior, which establishes a number of conjectures, but let me not go too much into the details here. For the purpose of this talk, let me just stick to these two results for the largest component. So now that we've studied in great detail the largest component, another question we can also ask is, what about the small component sizes? And this is something where this topic really connects to, say, enumerative combinatorics in some sense, because we can also ask, what about the number of vertices in components of size 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc.? And what can we say about their qualitative behavior? And one of the motivations here is perhaps that for Adasharani random graphs, it's a well-known fact that almost all components are that with high probability, almost all small components are trees. So combining these tree counting formulas with approximate independence of the edges, it's very easy to prove results about the number of vertices in small components in, say, the Adasharani random graph. However, as soon as you start looking into more complicated processes, into processes where you have dependencies between the edges, then this sort of explicit counting formula type approach very quickly breaks down. And so in some sense, the quest from the enumerative combinatorics community, in particular promoted by Dromotan Keng, was, can you come up with a new method that allows you to establish these Adasharani tree-like results for these more complicated processes, for processes where you have dependencies between the edges? And our proof methods are also strong enough to give that. So what we, for example, can show is if you look at the number of vertices in components of size k, at step TCN, say, plus minus epsilon n, then this scales like some constant k to the minus 3 over 2, and then some exponential term where the decay is some constant times epsilon square k. Okay, and this might look a little bit complicated on first sight, this formula, but again, take my word for it, it's exactly the same as you would see in Adasharani. So in Adasharani, you would, for example, know that this constant is equal to 2, and this constant is 1 over square root 2 pi, I think. Okay, so in Adasharani, you get exactly the same behavior up to these sort of value of these constants here. Furthermore, for those of you who like counting, this k to the minus 3 over 2 term is very typical for counting trees. It's a hallmark of tree counting. Okay, and this again establishes some conjectures by Kang, Perkins, Spencer, and Domota, Kang, and Panagiotou. Okay, let me maybe at this point stop enumerating more and more results. I hope by now it's sort of clear that this is not just a mere refinement of previous work, but that we really need to come up with some new ideas, some new proof techniques in order to establish a number of these open problems and conjectures.
Does this also give you the discrete duality principle?
So we've looked at it, but we haven't worked out the full details yet. So I would say very safely it is true, but we cannot prove it all the way down to the critical window yet. So the take-home message of these results, in some sense, is there's another question. Yes. So k is the size of the component. So you're counting here the number of vertices in components of size k.
So I want to ask another question about the linear curves. So the linear curves you mentioned for every random, it holds when epsilon is small, right? But here you require epsilon to be larger than some value depends on n. So what's the intuition?
Okay, so the question is, what is this n to, where does this n to the minus 1 over 3 come from, or why we have any condition on epsilon at all?
Yeah, why we have a condition that epsilon is greater than
10. Okay, so first of all, typically what you do in the classic, in these very basic adder training results, is you fix epsilon and then take n large as a function of epsilon. Yeah. Okay, what we do here is in some sense much stronger, because I can tell you can take epsilon as a function of n very small. So this is much stronger than just saying for large n depending on epsilon. And this condition here, so it turns out that if this condition is violated, if epsilon stays of order n to the minus 1 over 3, it's, for example, a very well-known result by for Adler Schwede random graphs, which is due to, I think, Pitel, Vucak, Wiermann, and also due to Aldus, that inside this critical window, the largest component is not concentrated. So you do have multiple components that are of roughly the similar size, and they have a distribution. So you can never prove such a kind of result if this condition does not hold. And if you want to know...
This model, right?
I'm sorry?
That's also known in this model, right?
Yes, that's right. This was this critical window result I mentioned earlier. So if you want to know where this epsilon n to the minus 1 over 3 comes from, then maybe ask me after the talk and I can say some more about it. So the idea was that these results show that in some sense the phase transition all bounded size rules looks like an Adler Schwede, and by looks like I mean if you look at the key statistics, then after suitable rescaling they have the same form as their Adler Schwede analogs. So the proof here is quite complicated. So it uses a blend of a variety of different techniques, ranging more from combinatorial methods to some analytic methods, say PDE theory, also the differential equation method that Nick Romald will later today talk about, also branching processes and so on and so forth. So I'm not going to have time to go into all the details, but I do want to, in a few moments, say something about the structure of the proof. So as a preparation, let's again perhaps remind ourselves we're studying bounded size rules. And in some sense, the main difficulty will be that we have dependencies between the edges. Okay, so to see this, let's maybe do a quick thought experiment. Suppose that we change the decision of your rule in one step. So instead of adding the first edge, we add the second one, or vice versa. What this effectively does is it effectively changes the component sizes of your graph. So whenever your process samples from these components in future steps, it will see different component sizes, which in turn means that your size rule might again make a different decision, and so on and so forth. In other words, changes can propagate throughout the evolution of these processes, and this is exactly what makes the analysis interesting and challenging. So how do we... address this? How do we overcome this difficulty? So here's the rough structure, say, of the proof. So suppose I just look at now this time t, and I want to study the process, say, at this later time tc plus epsilon. And say here is tc. Suppose, say, for the moment that we want to study the size of the largest components at this point in time. And what we're going to do is we're going to first look at the process at some earlier stage, say tc minus sigma, where you can think of sigma as a tiny, tiny constant. Think of sigma as like 10 to the minus 10 or something like that. And in the first step, we want to get a very detailed understanding, how does the graph look like at this earlier step? Okay, so what is the component size distribution? How many vertices are there in components of size 1, 2, 3, etc., etc.? Let's get a very detailed understanding of this situation. And then we somehow use this earlier point as an anchor for our proof. So we somehow want to say, okay, here we have a very good understanding of what's going on. Then in between, we want to do some kind of a two-round exposure argument where we gradually expose more and more information about the steps that are happening. And this is not quite the standard two-round exposure that you might know from random graph theory. It's something more tailored to the situation at hand. And I'm later going to tell you about how this works. But now let's just assume that we could do this so that we first get the detailed understanding here, expose information about these rounds using some kind of two-round exposure. Then the punchline will be that because we engineer this two-round exposure in a very careful way, we can understand the component size distribution here using branching process techniques. And we're very good at understanding branching processes, so that's in a sense why we can get very detailed results. Okay, so let me maybe repeat the high-level proof strategy here on the slide. So we first try to get a very detailed understanding of the graph at this earlier point in time, so where sigma is, say, some tiny constant, 10 to the minus 10. Then we somehow manage to expose information about these steps in two exposure rounds. And we'll design the two-round exposure round exactly in such a way that the second exposure round somehow looks like a branching process that we can analyze. So it's perhaps not quite a really a standard one, but it's still something that with some technical work we're able to analyze. So if you now would force me to compare our approach in two bullet points to previous work, then maybe these would be the two bullet points I would come up with. So I think on a conceptual level, one key difference to all of the previous work here is that we're able to track the process directly. So all of the previous work, what they will essentially do, following also a strategy of Aldous, is trying to approximate the evolution near the critical time using some simpler process. And this introduces a lot of also approximation errors, which, for example, for the approach of Janssen and Spencer introduces the wrong second-order error terms. So we're able to directly track the process also over this critical interval. And this is also one of the key reasons why we can allow now to for epsilon to be a function of n in this optimal way, because now we have our hands on the actual process. We do not need to work with some limiting object. We can directly work with the process, and this allows us to get this access to the finite size scaling behavior. So in the remainder now, I just want to explain to you how does this two-round exposure argument actually work. I think this is sort of a nice idea, which might also be useful in other contexts. So what we're going to do is now we're going to look at the graph after tc minus sigma times n many steps. And now we're going to partition the vertex set of the graph. So now we want to say, okay, let's look at the vertex set at this step tc minus sigma times n. Okay, so now we're just going to split up the vertex set into two parts. So say this is the entire vertex set, and we're going to put in here all the components that have size at most b. Okay, and we're going to call this set S for small. And then we put all the remaining components on the other side. So these are all components size bigger than B. This is L for large. Okay, suppose we have a few components just like this, say. And now the idea will be that we'll do our two-round exposure argument relative to this partition. So from now on, we're going to fix this partition into these two vertex classes. And then we're going to do the exposure relative to these sets S and L. Okay, so S and L are fixed from now on. So what are we going to do? So recall I mentioned earlier that it doesn't matter if we sample two random edges or four random vertices. So let's sample four random vertices here in the talk. So for each of these four random vertices, in each step, what are we going to reveal? Well, I'm going to tell you for each vertex, is it an S or is it an L? And only if the vertex is chosen from S, I'm also going to tell you which vertex did I actually pick in S. Okay, so this is sort of like a partial exposure of the information. You only know, is it an S, is it an L, and which one in S did I actually pick? In particular, what do we know about the vertices in L now? Well, if we know that the vertex is an L, then we now know that this vertex is chosen uniformly at random from L. Because we started off with a random choice from the entire vertex set, and if you now condition on your vertex being from L, then this is nothing else but just a uniform random choice from the vertex set L itself. Okay, so now we did this partial exposure, and you're probably asking yourself, so what's going on? Why is this useful? And the point is, I claim that this is already enough to make all the decisions of your process. In each round, you can say, will the process add the first edge or the second edge? So to this end, let's maybe just briefly recall that the decision, because we're looking at the bounded size rule, depends only on the sizes of our four vertices, C1 up to C4. And up to what level of precision? Well, we need to know it up to precision 1 up to B and larger than B. This is exactly the restriction that our rule makes its decision only based on this information. So the question now is, did we already reveal enough information to determine the size of each vertex up to that level of precision? And so the idea is, now we want to track inductively a little bit more. So suppose that we can track the edges in S. So suppose we added, these two edges to S. Suppose we can keep track of these edges somehow. The second piece of information I want to track is, how do the edges connect from S to L? So maybe there's also an edge going here, which somehow will end up somewhere on the right-hand side. So of course, by construction of our exposure, we do not yet know where this vertex will actually connect to on the right-hand side. We just know it will connect somewhere on the right-hand side, but we do not yet know where. Okay, so you can think of this sort of as like a stub, where we later on will decide where it will end. Okay, so suppose we have all this information. Can I now tell you the size of the component size of each vertex here in the graph? So let's start maybe with the simple case. Let's start with what happens if we sample a vertex from L. Well, how did we design L? We designed L that at the beginning of the interval, we put all components of size larger than B exactly in this set. So at any later step, we know definitely that each of these vertices will lie in a component of size bigger than B. That's done. We just report for all these vertices larger than B. So now we can focus on the vertices in S, on the vertices on this side. So suppose first we want to sample some vertex, say, from this component. It's a component which somehow connects to the right-hand side. Well, by the same argument, well, just because we have this connection to the right-hand side, we might not know where it connects to, but we definitely know that whenever it connects to the right-hand side, this alone already brings in more than B vertices into the component, so each of these vertices in here will definitely lie in a component of size larger than B. You can also report larger than B. So the only thing that's left is now that we just have a component which completely lives in S. So the edges in here were all added in S. But now we were able to track those edges as well, right? This was our assumption. We can track the edges added to S. So I can tell you very precisely what this component looks like. So in particular, I can report the size up to this 1 up to B in larger B precision. Okay. So in other words, just using this information, we're now able to say for each of the four vertices, what is the size up to this level of precision? Once I know that, I show these sizes to your rule. And then the rule will tell me, add the first edge, add the second edge. And once I have that information, that's enough exactly to update this data structure. So if your two edges were added just in S, just put them down. If you have an SL vertex, we know the endpoint in S, and the endpoint in the right-hand side in L is still open. Okay, so this is the nice thing about this two-round exposure, that we can sort of make all the decisions of the process, but we still have all this reservoir of random choices left that we can still work with. So let's maybe briefly summarize what we now know after this first exposure round. So what do we know, say, after the first exposure? Let's maybe slightly redraw this picture. So we had a bunch of components in here. Maybe some of them are sort of joined up. Maybe we have another one here. And now we know that some of them connect to the right-hand side via these SL edges. Okay, so we have sort of this thing. Here's a here's an edge, which somehow connects somewhere to the right-hand side. Maybe here there's two of them. And the key point was that for each of these n vertices, we know that they lie somewhere in L. So let's say, call these guys stubs. So the stubs connect to a random vertex in L. Say for the moment, let's just say just to a vertex in L. So each of these points will be connected to some guy in L. Now what we of course ignored so far is that we still have some components in the right-hand side, and that we're actually also adding edges to the right-hand side. This is what we sort of ignored so far, right? So the process will also add some edges where both endpoints lie in L. So in other words, we also need to add a bunch of say, LL edges here to the right-hand side. But now let's think about, again, how does the exposure work? So the exposure worked by only revealing information about the vertices, whether in S and L, and only in S I told you which one we selected. So the key point was that every vertex, any unrevealed vertex in L, is now chosen uniformly at random from L. So in particular, what we know is that each of these vertices, each of these stubs here, connects to a random endpoint in L. So this is a random vertex. And we also know that all the edges that we add to the right-hand side, all these LL edges, this corresponds to two random vertices in L. So we can think of them as random LL edges. Okay. So now we have this extremely nice description of the second exposure round, where we have a lot of nice randomness going on. Each of these components here on the left-hand side, if it has a connection to the right, it always connects to a uniform random vertex on the right-hand side. And furthermore, any edges that are added here to the right-hand side, these are again just choosing two uniform random vertices and connecting them. So this is now a very, very nice situation. It's sort of exactly engineered now to bring component exploration process arguments and branching process arguments into play. This is now a perfect situation for these kind of tools. So let me just briefly indicate how this might work. So suppose now you wanted to know what is the size of the vertex, the size of the component containing this particular vertex. How would sort of this usual component exploration strategy work? So we would first find all the vertices inside your own component. Then you would check for this vertex, is this vertex connected to any other vertices on the right-hand side via these random LL edges? So you check, is this vertex contained in any edges? So maybe it is, so maybe this is connected to this vertex up here via a random edge. Then we find these new vertices up here. Then we also check, is this vertex, maybe there's another connection, maybe over here, maybe that's it. So now we found these two connections on the right-hand side. But now we still need to take into account that these components from the left-hand side, that they also try to connect to the right-hand side. So now here we also need to check, does this vertex connect somehow to the left-hand side? So maybe we do the following. Maybe this vertex checks, am I connected to here? Maybe the answer is no. And then checks, am I connected to here? Yes. Maybe here the answer is yes. So what this means is now that this would become an edge in your actual graph. Then this would allow you to find these vertices over here. And now, of course, this vertex here, again, must connect to random vertex on the right-hand side. So maybe this one goes down here, finds this component, and this gives us, again, more vertices to find. And now you can repeat this over and over again, and eventually this will uncover the entire component containing this vertex B. And the punchline of these kind of arguments is that if you look at the exploration process and think about how many vertices does this find in each step, then this can be very closely approximated using branching process arguments. So basically, the number of vertices you find in each step, you can think of this as sort of a branching process. And we're very good at analyzing such branching processes, and this is, in the end, the reason why we can get such detailed results. As you might notice, it's perhaps not quite a standard branching process, but it's still something that we can analyze with some technical effort. Okay, so if we now sort of look back at what we did, is we started off with this two-round exposure argument, and the key idea was that if we design the two-round exposure argument in a very careful way, then we can understand the component size distribution using branching process techniques, and this is exactly the reason why in the end we can get these high-precision results. So of course here now I've sort of skipped over all the technical details really. Let me just mention two of them. So one thing that is very nice if you, for example, study Alder Schwaney and other graph models, is that you end up with, say, some nice Galton-Watson branching process. And for these kind of processes, you have explicit formulas available. And this really helps in the analysis. This really makes your life easier if you know exactly what the distribution is that you're working with. And in the context here, we know very little explicit knowledge about all the variables and functions involved. Maybe we know that it satisfies some differential equation, but we don't maybe know much more. Okay, so in the second one is, so I told you that we know everything so precisely, all these vertices and all components. The truth is, here I was cheating a little bit, we only know this up to certain approximation errors. And at some point, these approximation errors really start hurting, particularly if you want to go all the way down to the critical window. And just a word, these approximation errors, they're not just an artifact of analysis. In some sense, they're there. So let's just do very quickly, let's look at the number of isolated vertices in your graph. Take my word for it, they change with constant probability in each round. So with constant probability, you change the number of isolated vertices. But we look at the process of a linear number of steps. So just by central limit theorem type considerations, we already expect square root n deviations. And it turns out that that's sort of too large. In the analysis, at some point, you'll need to actively take care of these deviations. All right. So this is all I wanted to say here about the proof. So let me maybe summarize. So we are studying these bounded size Achleopoulos processes. And the main result was that qualitatively, all these bounded size rules show the same behavior as Alder Schwaney. And I think this plot of the fraction of vertices in the largest components really nicely illustrates this fact that each time you get this nice linear type growth behavior. So if we put on our mathematical physics hat, we could say that all these bounded size rules lie in the same universality class as Alder Schwaney. If we perhaps put on our marketing hat, we would say that no matter how clever you are in designing your rule or protocol, you'll always be forced into this Alder Schwaney-like behavior. Let me maybe finish with one open problem, which I think would be very nice to resolve. So in this work here, we studied bounded size rules, and we got very detailed results. And so now the question is, what can you say about unbounded size rules? So for example, the sum of the product rule that I mentioned earlier, I think would be very nice to get an understanding of these rules. Thank you very much. So you're asking now about Alder Schwaney. So I got this question a lot in the talks, and then I designed this red, the green, and the orange curves so that they never cross. So I've not thought about Alder Schwaney. And So the honest answer is I'm not sure. I think there's a major difference in studying these rules if you look at sort of close to the critical point, whereas very far away. And this behavior happens very, very far away from the critical point, so it's probably not so easy to answer. But here this orange and the green curve already indicate that it's probably quite delicate.
So you're dividing into S and L, small, large. You're doing this for the bounded size rules where B is a fixed constant. Would you be able to do something similar where B is, let's say, log N? Still, I mean, it tends to infinity, but very slowly. And then you could use, let's say, a bounded size rule, but then logarithmic in N. Is that feasible, you think?
I mean, with this kind of proof approach, so...
I mean, it would be the first...
Yes, so... There's one technical problem here, which sort of is really under the rug, is that
you're using the differential equation.
No, that's not the problem. The main point from a technical perspective is that we apply in the end branching process arguments. We apply at some point branching process arguments,
yep.
And the main contribution, basically, you need to think of in the following way: the main contribution, all the analysis. Action must happen in L.
Yep.
If B gets too big, most of the action would happen on this side, and then your argument would need to be very different. So right now we really use the fact that basically the growth of, for example, survival probabilities basically determined what happens on the right-hand side. But if you suggest making B very big, then most of the action would happen in S. So our second round of exposure would be almost useless because all the action already happened in the first round of exposure. So there's some delicate trade-off here. So what I'm saying is basically if B is too big, everything will happen in S almost.
So maybe a slightly different approach to try to go to unbounded size rules is if you're less ambitious and you don't want to go to some rule, go to something that for large component size is very close to this, to the uniform rule. So you don't have anything bounded, but approaching very fast, exponentially fast. This rule. Do you think that your approach would work? Or?
So just to understand. So you're suggesting something I don't quite understand what suggestion is.
If your component size is very large, it's almost. So right now, for large components, you just pick. I say if your component is very large, you do something which is almost that, but somehow.
I think what I'm confused about. So if here we just select them at random, basically that's as random as close to arbitrary as you can get. So you want to make this choice more similar to the product rule, or I don't.
I want to make it a slight deviation of what you're doing, where you can control the size of deviation. Size of the deviation goes. So just from a physical perspective, you would expect something like that to be in the same universality class. I'm looking for something which will not go to a different universality.
Yes. Without knowing about the details of this modification, it's hard to make a prediction, but maybe we can discuss it afterwards.
What about the transition point for these different rules? Do you know which are all real values possible for some set of rules, or do you understand for a given rule what the transition point is? Is there some way to calculate it?
Well, in principle, you can calculate it by solving certain differential equations, but that's sort of probably not so satisfactory answer.
Okay. So there's some sort of there must be some computable numbers in some sense. Right? So we can't get all possible numbers this way.
Yeah, so there definitely be some. So I think, for example, here's something that we don't understand, which I think we should be able to understand, is what's sort of the fastest and the slowest rule that's possible? For example, this is sort of an easier question, right? Just asking sort of find the extreme points of this interval. And I don't really know how to do it. It depends a lot, actually, on the model. So, for example, what I didn't tell you is that a lot of our proof actually works in the framework where you select four random vertices, and you can combine any of these six vertices, you can add this edge. And in that framework, the answer would already be quite different than if you just restrict yourself to sampling two random edges. So somehow your proof would need to take these kind of differences into account, and I'm not so sure how to do that. My suggestion is, though, or I would be willing to bet, that the fastest rule is the reverse product rule. So, and there's some good reason for this, because in some sense, the short story is there's some parameter, the so-called susceptibility, whatever that is, which determines the blow-up point. And this rule that I just described greedily in each point maximizes the change of this parameter. So it's very likely that this is the fastest rule, but I don't know how to prove that.
Were variants of this type of learning studied on random geometric graphs, random connection models, or things like that?
So I believe that in simulations, people have looked at such models, but in terms of rigorous mathematics, I'm not aware of any results, but maybe someone can correct me. At least I've not seen any.